You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Rebel and government negotiators deliberated today about who will lead a transitional government for Liberia, while aid workers warned that fighting in the north threatened tens of thousands of refugees. The debate and persistent fighting outside Liberia's capital come 2 days after Liberia's warring sides signed a power-sharing deal to end 14 years of conflict. President Charles Taylor cleared the way for the deal when he ceded power and took exile in Nigeria. Ledgerhood Rennie, a Liberian journalist, joined Peace Watch today to give an analysis of the peace deal that was just signed and conditions in Liberia now that President Charles Taylor has stepped down.
Well, the principal thing is that they've agreed that they will all join in a comprehensive government of national unity, if one would call it, to sort of run the country for 2 years and then build those democratic institutions needed to carry Liberia through to free and fair democratic elections in 2006. The people, remember, were contending that they wanted the elephant's share of the peace deal, but did not get it because of the insistence of international mediators, that is the United Nations and also ECOWAS, because they say they did not want to be seen as rewarding those who have brought war and destruction on their people. They did not seem to be rewarding them with public jobs and public power skittles. And so at the end of the day, they signed the deal and agreed that, yes, they will give the post of vice chairman and chairmanship to civil society and political party organizations. But yet, let me say to you that now with the names, the shortlisting of three Liberian individuals, the forerunner is Mrs. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, that of the Unity Party, Mr. Judith Bryant of the Liberia Action Party, and the third person is Mr. Rudolph Sherman of the TWP, that's the Turek Party of Liberia. These three individuals now will have to be nominated. Either one of them will be nominated to head this transitional government, which is now, I understand discussions are now going on in Accra, Ghana, with the belligerents, that's the Liberian government, Model, the Movement for Democratic Change in Liberia, and also LERD, the Liberians United for Reconciliation and Democracy, the main rebel group. These three groups will now meet, and I understand they are meeting at this moment, on the names of the three shortlisted individuals from the political parties to decide who becomes the chairman of this transitional government.
When are they likely to come to a decision about that?
We expect by later on this evening, in the next 2 hours, a couple of hours, one would say, given the fluidity of the discussions, one would say that in the next 5 to 6 hours, there will be definitely a person named to head this transitional government for a 2-year period.
Do you see either one of those three as more of a front runner or a stronger candidate than the other two? And if so, who would that be?
A lot of people are talking about Mrs. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who is a well-known international diplomat. She served in the United Nations system for years and has an impeccable record with finances and dealing with bilateral and multilateral financial institutions. She's also credited as coming second in the 1997 general and presidential elections, in which President Taylor won by 80-something percent of the votes. So a lot of people think that bringing her on would serve a useful purpose, because there are much-needed international assistance, and someone with the pedigree and the contacts internationally like her could may as well just pull the trick for Liberia.
By the end of the day, there may be a nominee for that or an appointed person to head up the new transitional government?
It is hoped so. A lot of pressure is being brought to bear by the mediators, that's the United Nations and ECOWAS, on the deliberations in Accra, Ghana. And so one can only but hope and speculate and conjecture that by the end of the day, let's hope that the belligerents, like I said, will come up with this single name that will head the transitional government for a 2-year period.
Ledgerhood, what is the mood of the average Liberian that you've spoken with on the streets of the capital of Monrovia? I'm sure they're glad that their 14-year civil war has finally come to an end, but are they hopeful about their country's political future?
Well, it's too soon to call the shots, because a lot of people are sort of cautiously optimistic. Remember, Liberians have gone through this a number of times now with these deals signed, and then the country slides back into another round of civil strife. And so they are cautiously optimistic about the process. And one can only hope that with this time, the involvement of the United Nations and the United States at a larger scale, one can only hope that they will bring in a new dimension that could sort of manifest peace for the Liberians, for the ordinary Liberian once and for all.
Of course, the war has actually ended, but the social and humanitarian situation is still dire by all accounts. Widespread hunger, lawlessness, and economic catastrophe just plaguing the country. What is being done in the immediate sense to address these issues and concerns?
Well, as I speak to you immediately, there is an influx of humanitarian aid coming in. A lot of international agencies have begun to put in their staff and bring in huge amount of aid, either through aircrafts or either to ships at the port of Monrovia. And some sort of distribution is now beginning to go around the various displaced centers where thousands of people are. It is not completely stabilized yet, but I do know for sure that a lot of efforts are being made by the humanitarian agencies coordinated by the United Nations. And one can only but hope and say that in the next couple of weeks, the situation could become stabilized.
What about the former deposed President Charles Taylor, who's been granted exile in Nigeria? Is he now likely to be brought up on war crime charges?
It's something that I cannot speak about because I really do not know the intention of the international community regards these war crimes charges on President Taylor. I think it's something left for the Sierra Leonean court. I think it's something left to the international players in the Liberian peace process. And for now, I think all concentration is on the military stabilization of the situation, the political stabilization of the situation at home, and then perhaps in a longer run, people can begin to look at whether or not it is feasible in terms of reconciliation and justice and peace to bring anybody, not only President Taylor, but all those who one way or the other have brought death and destruction and the pillaging of our society to book. Let me just say on a larger scale that the Liberian crisis has taken a great international dimension. And let me thank all of the Western as well as local media for helping Liberia, putting Liberia crisis on the map and giving it the sort of international attention it deserves. I'd just like to, on behalf of all of our people here, thousands of them, millions if not thousands of them, say thanks to all of you and continue to watch the process with an eagle eye, because I think the more attention is drawn to the Liberian situation, the more people will begin to help this country help itself. And let me just conclude by saying that a high-power United Nations assessment mission will be arriving in Liberia on Thursday to begin the process that will lead to the United Nations taking over the whole peace process by November. Remember, there was a United Nations resolution calling for the UN forces to begin their deployment here on October 1. But given the sort of logistical constraints and the sort of hard bargaining and other processes involved with getting a large-scale humanitarian mission, military as well, yeah, they're saying now there may be a month delay. So they're talking about November 1 to begin the process. One can only but hope and ask all of our international friends like you all to continue to keep Liberia on the agenda and continue to push forward so that Liberia can become a place of civilized human beings and people once and for all.
Liberian journalist Ledger Hood Rennie.
Even when the greedy people strip you of your identity,
we'll recognize you anywhere. We'll recognize you anywhere. And we will love you forevermore.
from the group Nasir featuring Jake D. Closer to home, peace activists and civil rights leaders are commemorating the 40th anniversary of the historic March on Washington this weekend. A coalition of more than 100 organizations, along with people from across the country, will gather here in the nation's capital to remember the end of legalized racial segregation and the birth of a movement of nonviolent peace activism. Speaking earlier this week with host Damu Smith on Pacifica Station WPFW, longtime civil rights leader and chair of the NAACP, Julian Bond, spoke about this weekend's events as well as the intersection of the civil rights and anti-war movements.
One of the youth members of our board of directors came to the podium and introduced this resolution opposing unilateral war in Iraq. It was something we'd not expected or asked for. Frankly, I wasn't sure of the sentiment within the NAACP, but the resolution passed unanimously. There was not a single vote against it. There was no discussion. Everybody agreed that unilateral war was an awful, awful idea. And I think our predictions have been proven right. Pick up the paper every day, and you see the United States is sinking deeper and deeper and deeper into quicksand in Iraq. And you can only be reminded of Vietnam. And you know that the Bush administration had no plan for what to do after the war was over. It was given that we, with our mighty military might, would prevail, but no plan for what to do when it was over, and we're sinking deeper and deeper every day. Talk about just one thing. Think about the amount of money that's spent there that could be spent here. Think about the lives lost. Somebody told me, and I don't know if this is true, that the most common name among the dead is Gonzalez. Mm-hmm. What does that say? Mm-hmm. What does that say about who fights our wars? What does that say about who's in the military today? Mm-hmm. Gonzalez. Think about that. So we were proven right, sadly so. We didn't want to be right. Mm-hmm. We were proven right, and I think all Americans are now paying the consequences.
Julian Bond, chair of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, speaking on Pacifica Station WPFW here in the nation's capital. Also scheduled for this weekend is a commemoration of the life of Bayard Rustin, who was very instrumental in organizing the 1963 March on Washington. In his book, Lost Prophet, The Life and Times of Bayard Rustin, Dr. John DeMilio focuses on an important visionary of the 20th century. His subject, Bayard Rustin, is one of the most brilliant strategists of the Civil Rights Movement, a man who brought Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolence to America, but a man who is largely forgotten in the histories of those times. He spoke with Pokey Anderson on Sunday Monitor at Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston.
Tell us a little about his personality. One of your person that you talked to said he was a four-way outsider. He was black, but he also moved in white circles. He was Quaker and pacifist. He was gay, and he had an artistic temperament. And you also added he many other things, that he was an illegitimate son of a working-class teenager. But then he was also this Renaissance man who was a track and football star, an excellent orator, a poet, a tenor, all these things.
Right. He was a young man of extraordinary talents. And it's, you know, his story is a story that, I don't know, gives hope and, you know, optimism to sort of to anyone, because he grew up without privilege, and yet he grew up able to be excellent in not only creatively in terms of art and music, but he was articulate as a speaker. He was charismatic in his presentation of self. He used song wonderfully in organizing. I mean, he could move back and forth as a platform speaker between oration and singing when that seemed appropriate, and had a tremendous impact on the young people whom he came in contact with throughout his career. And he almost chose a career in the arts. He was on Broadway with Paul Robeson in the late 1930s, but he just sort of settled on being an agitator for justice, and I think that's the way I would describe him. He used all of the talents that he had, and those talents were immense, to try to create a world of peace between nations and respect between social groups.
He had some early encounters with sticking up for his beliefs. He refused to sit in the back of the bus in 1942 and was severely beaten. He he raised quite a ruckus when he went to prison as a pacifist, refusing to fight in World War II. I mean, he wasn't just for show, obviously.
No, he and his courage was remarkable. And people that I interviewed, 30 or 40, 50 years after they had initially encountered Rustin, that was one of the things that they immediately focused on, that this was a man who in some ways was incredibly gentle and in his demeanor, who often did not put himself forward, and yet his courage was extraordinary. You know, the incident that you mentioned, this was in Tennessee in 1942, riding a bus on his own and making the decision that he just was not going to tolerate the indignity any longer. And, in that period of time, he risked being lynched for doing that. His courage was an inspiration to the people who knew him, and it gave him tremendous credibility as an organizer, because he was never asking people to do something that he himself had not done.
Philip Randolph, you write about as having the original idea to have a march on Washington, and in the 40s, right?
Right. Right. And Randolph first proposed a march on Washington in 1941, before the United States entered World War II, but when defense production was really gearing up. And in that setting, he called for a march of black Americans on the nation's capital in order to protest both discrimination in the armed services and in defense employment. And he never had to bring that march to Washington, because President Roosevelt provided a key concession a couple of weeks beforehand. But the idea of a march on Washington never quite died, and it exerted a fascination for Randolph, and to some extent for Rustin, too. And so a generation later, when the civil rights movement was really on the march, Randolph and Rustin together thought, well, maybe now is the time to do that march that never happened back in the 1940s. Let's do it now in 1963. And that was the moment, really, when Rustin, made it into the national consciousness as the primary organizer of that historic march on Washington.
So the advances of the 60s certainly didn't come out of a vacuum.
Absolutely not. And even they didn't even come out of entirely the things that we do remember, like the Montgomery bus boycott or the sit-ins and freedom rides of 1960 and 61. Part of what to me is so fascinating about Rustin's career and what it teaches us is that the big moments of change that we associate with the 1960s, so much invisible work went on beforehand, and Rustin was one of the key people in the 40s and 50s who was testing out nonviolent resistance to segregation and racial inequality. So that by the time of a march on Washington or the time of the sit-ins, that idea had been seeded throughout African-American communities in the United States, and Rustin wasn't the only one, but he was a key figure.
How was it that he got associated with Martin Luther King and tell about how his ideas and Gandhi's ideas were injected into the civil rights movement?
Well, it's wonderful. I mean, and when the bus boycott began at the end of 1955 and early 1956, Rustin had been doing this sort of work for a decade and a half, and he went down to Montgomery after a couple of months or so, and just introduced himself to King. And, in some ways, the two couldn't have been more different. A Southerner, a Northerner, a Baptist, a Quaker, a person of cosmopolitan interests the way Rustin was, someone like King who, was primarily a product of the Southern African-American tradition. But they hit it off immediately, and Rustin had a way of fostering confidence in King, that King could see the value of Rustin's advice and experience. And Rustin became a primary advisor of King for the rest of the 1950s. He wrote the plans that led to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And he managed to do this and establish that relationship with King, even as he was known to be gay and had this stigma, you know, trailing around with him that, oh my God, here is a person who is outside the norms of respectability. And yet he and King were able to hit it off. It's to be remembered.
John D'Amelio is professor of history, gender, and women's studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago, a former Guggenheim Fellow, and has written a number of books. Activists in Washington, D.C. screened a new documentary earlier this week about the history of the Weathermen, a radical anti-war group that orchestrated a series of bomb attacks across the country throughout the 1970s to bring the violence of the Vietnam War closer to home. After the film, they held a panel discussion about the role of violent versus nonviolent activism in fomenting political change. Among the speakers was Dr. Yohuru Williams, an associate professor of history and director of black studies at Delaware State University.
Movements are organic. You need both sides. You need a Roy Wilkins in the NAACP to set a moderate tone so that a Martin Luther King or a Malcolm X or a Bobby Seale, Huey Newton, Kathleen Cleaver, you need those layers of a movement in order to have a true movement. It's the diversity of opinion. It's the differences in approach that provide for movements, in many ways, the kind of clear-cut victories that they gain. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, is it a victory of nonviolence, or is it fear of violence? Is it Watts that motivates the signing of the Civil Rights Act? Is it Malcolm X's angry rhetoric, or is it Dr. King's eloquent statement on behalf of human brotherhood and confraternity at the March on Washington? You need it all.
Dr. Yohuru Williams, an associate professor of history and director of black studies at Delaware State University. Political scientist and former Brookings Institute research fellow Stephen A. Cook spoke about the concept as it relates to political events in the Middle East.
Whether violence is justified or not as a form of protest really depends where you stand on the particular issue. This is the perennial issue that we find in the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is, you know, who's a terrorist and who's not a terrorist? Are Hamas people who blow up Israeli buses, are they terrorists or are they freedom fighters? Are they just defending their homeland from aggression? Was Menachem Begin, who the former prime minister of Israel, and Yitzhak Shamir, both of them part of underground movements in pre-Israel Palestine, engaged in violence against all kinds of targets, including the King David Hotel? Also, many states in the international system were born of acts of terrorism.
But the discussion of what's violent and what's nonviolent isn't always as black and white as it may appear. Again, Dr. Yohuru Williams, an associate professor of history and director of black studies at Delaware State University.
If one looks at the American history from the perspective of oppressed peoples, in particular Native Americans and African Americans, then Manifest Destiny, for instance, in which the United States claimed that it was its divine right to spread from one end of the continent to the other, clearly was an example of terrorism against the people who owned that land, who possessed that land, who were there. The Trail of Tears could be seen as a terroristic campaign against Native Americans, the Cherokee Nation. A lynching in the United States could clearly be seen as an act of terror perpetrated not just by organizations such as the Ku Klux Klan, which is widely recognized as a white terroristic organization, but hundreds of other groups that operated in the South and the Midwest between 1865 and 1930. You've got the Black League, the Knights of the White Camellia, the John Birch Society. One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. It is a trite expression, but it's one that's very true. And in that context, it's difficult to evaluate sometimes where you fall down.
Participants in a roundtable discussion held earlier this week after the screening of The Weathermen Underground, a new film about the radical 1970s anti-war group, The Weathermen. Thanks to Ingrid Drake for production assistance with that piece. Finally, tonight, we continue with a speech from 68-year-old peace activist and Dominican nun Jackie Hudson, who was recently sentenced to 2.5 years in federal prison, along with her fellow sisters Ardith Platy and Carol Gilbert, who received sentences ranging from 2 to 3 years. Hudson cut through a chain-link fence in northwest Colorado last October and entered the U.S. military's Minuteman III missile silo. Wearing white outfits bearing the title Disarmament Specialists and calling themselves the Sacred Earth and Space Plowshares II, the nuns proceeded to hammer on the concrete silo lid, enacting the biblical prophecy of hammering swords into plowshares and bringing an end to war. Several weeks before her sentence was handed down, Hudson spoke to a crowd in Seattle, Washington, about nonviolent action as a force for positive social change.
At this point in history, I think we are the closest that we have ever been to banning war forever. I think we have become so brutal and so barbaric in the way we wage war that the millions in the streets prior to our invasion of Iraq spoke volumes as to where many people living on the planet today are. And I think it's one of our major tasks is to keep that momentum going, to keep that power going for this dynamic point in history. Without that, we will never have economic justice. We will never solve the housing, education, medical needs of the people in this country. So I would urge you to stay with it, to stay in the path, using your energies wherever you feel you need to be. I can't say what you need to do or where you need to be. That has to be your decision. Because we're all in this together. We're all in this big circle. None of us is more important than the other in this activity. And we must all take the personal responsibility to do something. Biggest message, or the most powerful message, is the personal message of one-to-one, whether it be to your family members, whether it be to folks that you work with, folks that you walk the streets with. I think there's too large a population struggling for survival, and they don't have time to think about ICBMs in Colorado. They don't have time to think about tridents at Bangor. But it's up to us to try to make those connections, because they are into survival because of these ICBMs and the tridents and the military budget that is so outlandish. Over $1 billion a day is being spent on the military. $1 billion a day. We can't even wrap our heads around that. I mean, that's just out of our ability to connect with that. The information is available, though. There are many, many available sources in this community, and I would ask you to make those known to your friends, to your families, in your workplace, so that we do come with a more educated citizenry that can actually exercise their American citizenship in a knowledgeable and in a productive way. I think the power is in you speaking to the people that you know. And the people you know appreciate what you are and who you are and what you're saying, and would tend to believe you more than they would tend to believe me. That, I think, is where the groundswell came for the millions in the streets prior to the attack on Iraq. I would just like to close with two little quotes. This one was on the refrigerator of one of our supporters in Colorado Springs. And the quote is, "Just when the caterpillar thought it was the end of the world, it became a butterfly." And the other one is from Joan Chittister, and I believe it applies very much to my life. "Hope sends us dancing around dark corners, trusting in a tomorrow we cannot see." Thank you very much.
Dominican nun Jackie Hudson speaking last month in Seattle, Washington. She was recently sentenced to 2.5 years in federal prison for her nonviolent protests. Thanks to Ed Mays and Mike McCormick for production assistance with that piece. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hamid of KPFA and Benta Berkland. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.